Well, for one who is inclined to preach on a historical topic this weekend, the Supreme Court's decision in the Hobby Lobby case was either conveniently or providentially timed. Now, I'm not going to get into the specifics of this particular ruling, but I will note that this decision has given spur to a bit of conversation around religious liberty and the First Amendment to our Constitution. And so this July 4th weekend seems like a good time for us to reflect for a few minutes on just where we have been and where we might be going in terms of our freedom of worship in the United States of America. Now, we here in the Congregational Church like to take great pride in the role we have played in our nation's founding. Come Thanksgiving, we thump our chests with pride because it was the Pilgrims who sat down and feasted with the Native Americans and gave thanks to God for God's bounty and for helping to establish them in the New World. And then we think about the Puritans with their meeting houses and their small d democratic form of congregational governance, which gave birth to town meeting, still used throughout New England. And we think again from our church this great gift to the wider body politic. But before we become too pleased with ourselves, we should remember that not everything is rosy when we look at Congregationalists and their history in New England and America. Indeed, it is because of our forebears' actions that we have the First Amendment to the Constitution. You may recall that throughout the 17th century, Congregationalists ran New England. They ran the churches, they ran the government. And indeed, right throughout the colonial period, right throughout the 18th century, and indeed into the early 19th century in New England, the Congregational Church was the established church. That meant that your taxes went to pay for people like me to preach in churches. And your taxes went to build and maintain structures like this, but only for congregational churches. The Baptists were out of luck. The Quakers, sorry. The Catholics, we're not even going to acknowledge you are here. Now, in the southern colonies, it was the Anglican Church that occupied this special privileged position. And while the Congregationalists and the Anglicans had different ways of organizing themselves and running their communities, they shared something critical in common. And that was that they both found ways to prove Lord Acton was right. Power corrupts. And so the established churches and their associates in government would find ways to oppress and abuse those who practice other forms of Protestant Christianity. If you wanted to build a Baptist church or officiate at a Baptist wedding, your clergy had to get permission from the congregational or Anglican authorities. You had to go to the people who said that you were a dissenter, or a nonconformist, or even better, a heretic. Not surprisingly, Baptists and Quakers and others who did not adhere to the dominant form of religion weren't particularly excited about this arrangement. And it was this reality that shaped the thinking of many of the founders of this country. Now, we all know that in 2014, debates about the meaning of the First Amendment, of the Establishment Clause, and the Free Exercise Clause are still raging. And people from different perspectives will claim that the founding fathers support their position. There are those who will say all of the founders were what we would call today secular humanists. And others who will say that they were all Orthodox Trinitarian Christians. Well, of course, the reality is far more complex. There were founders who were indeed Orthodox Trinitarian Christians. People like Roger Sherman, John Hancock, Sam Adams. But when we look at the people who are at the center of the story we like to tell, people like Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and most important to our story today, James Madison, things are a little bit more complicated. They were all in their own ways varieties of what we today would call Unitarians. They believed in God, and they believed that God was active in the affairs of men and women in the world. But you will not find them running off to take communion. You would not find them offering confessions of faith, saying that Jesus was their Savior. They talk about God, but in very general terms. And each of these men came to their understanding of God and religion through their experience of the world. Ben Franklin grew up in Puritan Boston. And then, in his early 20s, he moved to Philadelphia, a far more cosmopolitan place. And he saw how people from different walks of life and different religions were able to get together and create a vibrant, prosperous city. George Washington led the first truly national institution that this country had, the Continental Army. We had soldiers from Congregationalist Massachusetts and from Anglican Virginia, Moravians from Pennsylvania, Presbyterians from New Jersey. And Washington realized that a one-size-fits-all approach wasn't going to work. He knew that if he was going to talk about religion and God, he had to do ways that drew people in. John Adams was descended from Puritan clergy. Indeed, as a young man at Harvard, he'd considered going into the ministry himself. He ultimately decided otherwise, fearing that it would be a brain-deadening career. Instead, he went into the law, where he made his name. He remained active in the church in Quincy, Massachusetts throughout his life, but that church, which originally was a Trinitarian congregational church, became Unitarian. And we all know about Thomas Jefferson and his very interesting views on faith. Intriguing, inspiring, confounding. Jefferson was a free thinker. And he wanted to make sure that America was a place that would be safe for people like him. And then there was James Madison. James Madison, who more than any other founder was responsible for the country in which we live today. James Madison, who was involved in events from the Revolution through the drafting of the Constitution to the presidency during the War of 1812. Madison, throughout his career, had the opportunity to reflect on what religion and the state should mean to one another. He was president in 1776 when Virginia adopted its constitution, a constitution that called for a separation of church and state. In 1785, he wrote the Memorial Remonstrance opposing a move in the legislature in Virginia to provide for financial support for churches. His experience was formed through personal observation and things he saw. He married a Quaker, ultimately, Dolly Madison. He went to the College of New Jersey, now known as Princeton, a place filled with Presbyterians and the forebears of today's evangelicals. And then he watched what happened to the Baptists in his own home county of Orange in Virginia. And there they were oppressed and even indeed persecuted. And he saw there that when the state and the church became entangled, it was good for neither of them. And so as debates raged and the Constitution was drafted, he held out for a separation of the two. And there were people who thought that the Constitution provided too much power to the central government. And so, even though he at first did not believe it was necessary, he came to support the inclusion of a Bill of Rights. Now, even back then, the House and the Senate disagreed on things. And there was a lot of jockeying and horse trading that went on back and forth between the two chambers. Madison let the Senate take the lead in writing the 2nd through 10th Amendments. He did that because he wanted to preserve the House's language, which he'd been so instrumental in writing for the first. And you'll remember how the First Amendment to the Constitution begins. These are the first words in the Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The freedom of religion is indeed our first liberty in this republic. Now, that this language could be developed and adopted by such a diverse group of people is really remarkable, because there were folks like Jefferson who had very loose notions of who God was. And then there were people like Roger Sherman who had very orthodox beliefs. But they'd all come to understand that if the national government was to thrive, there had to be space created for difference. They realized that there were so many different denominations and sects, no group was ever going to prevail. Back in 1776, 99% of the people in the colonies were Protestant. Now, that might sound awfully homogenous compared to today's America, but those Protestants included Congregationalists and Presbyterians and Anglicans and Moravians and Anabaptists and Quakers. The list goes on and on and on. Think to today's diversity of religion. 25% of the American public is Catholic today. Around 55% Protestant. We've got as many flavors of Baptists as you can imagine, of Presbyterians, of Methodists, of people affiliated with no particular Christian denomination. And then, of course, beyond the Christian church, Sikhs, Hindus, Muslims, Jews, you name it, we've got it here. The founders of our country recognized that establishing a state religion could never work here. And Madison believed that establishment also included funding. But the reason this got through was the Constitution, as written in 1787, and debated and ratified in 1788, was only supposed to apply to the national government. So people who thought that there should be state churches were perfectly happy, because back at home in Massachusetts or Connecticut, the established church remained. But times changed. People's understandings of things changed. And by 1833, the last of the churches was disestablished. And that was in Massachusetts. That happened not because the Congregationalists had come to the realization that an expansive view of religious freedom was what God called for. No. They'd lost their power to the Unitarians, who were taking over the local churches, who'd taken over the state government. And all of a sudden, the Congregationalists understood what it was the Baptists had not liked for the last two centuries. They didn't want to pay for the other guy's minister, the other person's church. And so the last of the established churches fell away, and a remarkable thing happened over the ensuing decades. Church membership and participation increased throughout the country. No longer were congregations seen as an arm of the state. It was a huge development. And of course, life marched on, and our country was engaged in a great civil war in the middle of the 19th century, and in its wake, the 14th Amendment was passed. No state would be allowed to abridge the right of any citizen, and so a huge change took place. The First Amendment, originally intended only for the federal government, was to be applied to the states. People didn't notice the big change at first, but by the middle of the 20th century, with Supreme Court rulings in 1947 and 1962 and 1963, involving things like public prayer and prayer in the schools, the debate about religious freedom was no longer just taking place at a national level, but at the community level. Those debates are still taking place today. And sometimes we can lose sight of what a truly privileged and blessed state we live in today. Yes, there are arguments going on, and there are people who are unhappy, and sometimes we might think, boy, I wish it was the way it was back then. But here we are, 2 days after celebrating the 238th birthday of our country, worshiping as we please. We don't need anybody's permission. We don't need anybody's okay. And we do that as a distinct religious minority. The United Church of Christ, within the wider Christian church in the United States, we're a footnote. But that's okay, because we have this heritage to draw on, this gift of freedom, this gift of religious liberty. Debates will continue, and people will argue their positions, but our call as Americans who profess to be Christians is to always do so, remembering that our first loyalty isn't to our vision of what the church should be, but to that shared with us by Jesus Christ. We heard the words from Matthew today, words that draw on the tradition of Deuteronomy, of an expansive faith, of a viewpoint that recognizes the world is larger than any of us. So this weekend, as we continue to enjoy barbecues, go to a rain-delayed parade, maybe watch fireworks that we videotaped or recorded on the DVR, let's also celebrate by giving thanks to those wise people of 200 years ago who fashioned a system of government that allows us, with great freedom, to follow the call of Jesus Christ.